Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George Washington is revered as the father of our country. But my guest today, master biographer Ron Chernow, says he's actually been whittled down in the telling of history. A few centuries of myth-making, Chernow says, have shaved off the sharp edges of Washington's fiery character, making him a less interesting, less understandable, and ultimately less impressive figure. It's time, he says, to remedy that. This hour on Point, a big new look at George Washington. You can join the conversation. Do you have a real sense of Washington the man? Is he more or less impressive, freed from the myth? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York City is Ron Chernow, award-winning biographer of Alexander Hamilton, John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, and now father of the nation, George Washington. His new book is Washington, A Life. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ron Chernow, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
It's a real pleasure to be here with you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
There is so much to dive into here. This is a very rich telling. But you start off observing that George Washington has become almost sphinx-like somehow, leaving readers, you know, or Americans with a sort of frosty respect for him. You want to replace that with a visceral appreciation. We'll get to the visceral appreciation, but what's that reduced form that we kind of imagined in our mind's eye when we think of Washington?
You know, unfortunately, I think that so many Americans have this image of Washington as this a bland and boring figure, somehow an ordinary man who happened to be at the right place at the right time, and he accidentally stumbles into greatness. Instead, I tried to replace this with the story of an extraordinary man who did extraordinary things, and somebody whom I discovered was a very passionate, complex, sensitive man, a man of many moods and fiery opinions, but it's all cloaked under that aura of reserve, that stoical facade. We know this stereotype, but I think we don't really know what was underneath it. His contemporaries did.
They did, and we'll talk about it. You're right. It was not exactly a placid golden age. We'll look at that. Let's deal with the myths first, because it's amazing how many people, I mean, you've said, many observe, that's all people know. Cherry tree story. Chopped it down. You know the story.
Well, the cherry tree story was actually invented within a few years of Washington's death by an itinerant preacher and bookseller named Parson Mason Locke Weems. As you know, it has had an amazing longevity.
I cannot tell a lie.
And it's had a very unfortunate effect on Washington's image, because it's been used to terrorize American school children for two centuries now.
The father of the nation didn't lie when he chopped down the cherry tree. You mustn't ever, ever lie now.
Exactly. It makes him seem like this very, very cold, priggish character. And it's terrible when you're beating children over the head with this figure instead of inspiring them with stories that really make children love and honor him. And it's complete fabrication.
Wooden teeth. You've got this magnificent portrait of Washington on horseback on the cover of the book. It's the Rembrandt Peale portrait, Washington before Yorktown. And his horse is muscular, and he's muscular, and is just as, but that's, never a smile, and that kind of grim mouth always. What was going on with those teeth?
Okay, let me talk about the teeth, because in fact they are important. He didn't have wooden teeth. He had dentures that were made either of walrus or elephant ivory. They actually had inserted into them, Tom, real teeth. Nine of them may have been teeth that he bought from his own slaves, but the teeth are very important.
Bought from his own slaves. We'll get to slaves. That's a thought.
We'll get to that.
Big part of it.
Big part of it. But what happened, by the time he became president, he just had this one lonely lower left bicuspid, and the dentures were anchored onto it. Now, I discovered by examining them, they look like wood because over time, the ivory cracked and stained and developed a grainy look. But what I discovered was really important was less the composition of the dentures than the construction, because they were connected in the back of his mouth, the top and bottom portions, by these curved metal springs. What this meant, Tom, is the only way that they could be held in his mouth was if Washington kept his lips tightly shut. It meant that every time as his president he spoke, it would release the pressure of the springs, and there was the fear that his dentures would suddenly come flying out.
So he had to be the strong, silent type.
Well, I noticed that all of his speeches as president, a lot of them are just one, two, three paragraphs long, and I think I found the reason for that.
You remind us, I mean, we want to look back at the man himself, then we'll get into his wartime leadership and his first presidency, so important in this country's history.
Sure.
He was very conscious that he was the only major founder who did not have a college education. He had a real education in life, no kidding. But, you know, Adams went to Harvard, Madison to Princeton, Hamilton to Columbia. Washington talked about his own defective education. Give us a sense of his youth. What kind of family was he from? How did he come up?
He was born in what they call second-tier gentry in Virginia. His father owned 50 slaves and 10,000 acres. That sounds quite substantial. So this is not someone who lifted himself up by his bootstraps. But Washington was an intensely ambitious young man who wanted to enter the first rank of gentry. And the first rank of gentry owned hundreds of slaves and tens of thousands of acres, which Washington eventually did. He developed as his patrons, the Fairfax family. They controlled 5 million acres in Virginia.
Wow.
The so-called Northern Neck Proprietary between the Potomac and the Rappahannock. They also owned a lot of land out in the Shenandoah Valley. And Washington starts as a surveyor when he's 15 or 16, and a lot of his early assignments come from the Fairfax family. So he always had these powerful sponsors in the background.
It's not mythology that he was a physically impressive man, both in musculature and bravery, and in a way, luck, a kind of immunity to bullets became his reputation, and not without reason.
Yes, actually, during the French and Indian War, because there's 5.5 years in the French Indian War, by the age of 23, George Washington, who was a prodigy, was the head of all the armed forces in Virginia. This was a man who was always smack in the middle of the fighting. There was a battle on the Monongahela River in Pennsylvania where Washington took 4 bullets in his hat and coat. 2 horses were shot from under him. There was a whole mythology that started, even among the Indians, who felt that some supernatural power was protecting Washington. And after that battle, there was actually a Presbyterian minister who said that Providence must be saving the heroic young Colonel Washington for some signal service to his country in the future. Well, that was one of the more prophetic sermons in history.
And his durability, not just proven not just that way, and maybe not just mythological. I mean, smallpox, you remind us, killed so many soldiers in the Revolutionary War. He had it early on and therefore maybe was immune.
Was immune. You know, the 18th century, every neighborhood was constantly swept by epidemics. By the time Washington is 30 years old, he has survived malaria, smallpox, dysentery, and then we'll have many other diseases. You know, it's interesting, Tom, because everyone says in the 18th century, maybe life expectancy, for man was 49 or 50. Washington lives for 67, until 67. Actually, the next 5 or 6 presidents, except for one, all live into their 80s. And even John Adams reaches 90. The reason being that if you were able to survive the diseases that were rampant in the 18th century, if you hit 50, you were off and running to 70 or 80.
6 feet tall by his notes to the tailor in London when he ordered clothing there. A great horseman, you write. No small part of that move from second to first tier, aristocracy in that case, it came in his marriage to Martha, though it was complicated by his deep affections, maybe more, for the wife of a friend.
Yes, he is quite smitten with his neighbor and friend's wife, Sally Fairfax. Actually, on the eve of his engagement to Martha, writes a letter to Sally that's a declaration of love. We don't know whether he was testing the waters one last time or wanted some, you know, validation of his feelings. In the 18th century, marriage was considered a very practical arrangement. I mean, love and friendship were certainly important, but in marrying Martha Dandridge Custis, who was a widow, slightly older than George, Martha had two children. Perhaps more to the point, Martha owned 18,000 acres around Williamsburg and controlled 300 slaves. So this marriage indeed catapults George Washington into that top rank of gentry that he has always sought to enter.
And it was a long and a successful marriage. You're right. She was with him for maybe half of the long years of the war. She was on the road in the field with George.
Yes. You know, it's always said Martha Washington joined him, you know, in his winter quarters during the 8.5 years of the war. Well, actually, it was approximately half of the time, because those winters often stretch to 5 or 6 months. I think that this was not probably not a torrid or lusty marriage, but it was a very deep and happy friendship. Martha not only gave Washington extraordinary financial security. Washington was a reserved and private man. So Martha was his emotional confidant, I think. Washington was cordial, but a bit aloof. Martha was a tremendous social asset. She was very skillful in meeting and greeting people and putting them at their ease. And so I think that she really gives a kind of security and stability to what had prior to that point been a somewhat rootless life.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real George Washington, the passionate man behind the wooden mythology, with biographer Ron Chernow. His big new book is Washington, A Life. We're going to dive in deep with Ron Chernow. It's funny how he's been treated through time. Here's a little bit, just a touch from the 2008 HBO miniseries John Adams, depicting some of the career and presidency of George Washington. Here's a clip where Benjamin Franklin, played by Tom Wilkinson, introduces John Adams, played by Paul Giamatti, to Colonel George Washington, played by David Morse. In 1774, at the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia, Adams notices that Washington is wearing a black armband.
Colonel, you are in mourning.
From Massachusetts, Mr. Adams. An attack made on one of our sister colonies is an attack made on all of us.
If only all of the Congress were of your sentiments, sir.
I am prepared to raise 1,000 men, subsist them at my own expense, and march them myself to the relief of Boston.
Well, we may yet have need of your generosity.
Not generosity, Mr. Adams. Duty.
A natural leader.
He's always the tallest man in the room. He's bound to end up leading something.
Duty bound there, Colonel George Washington in the miniseries John Adams. Ron Chernow calls listeners lined up for you. Anne in Middlesex, Vermont. You're on with Ron Chernow.
Hi. I read a lot of history from that era. And I've noticed that George Washington especially, and the other founders, but George Washington especially, had a very strong sense of what was really happening and how this would, his image, he was really, really conscious that his image be immortalized. And everything he did was calculated so that he would be remembered down the ages as this strong and you know, strong leader with high integrity, and down to, you know, handing over the sword to the leaders after the war, not taking over, you know, every action he took, and every stance, and very, very conscious that that his image was so important that it, you know, even now that we're talking about him.
Yeah, and there's a reason for that. And you go right to one of Ron Chernow's major themes. I mean, describe for us, Ron, the ambition and what calculating or cautious quality as you like in life and also for his
posterity. Well, I think
posterity.
He was, you know, yeah, I think he wasn't the only founder who was constantly tending his image and very aware of his future fame. Washington was very aware of himself as a historic personage. One of the things that fascinated me in doing the research was discovering that during the Revolutionary War, when Washington is constantly complaining to the Congress about a shortage of manpower and money, he asked Congress for a special appropriation for a team of secretaries who do nothing for 2 years but create a beautiful edition of 28 volumes of his wartime correspondence, which he thought would be his legacy. So I think that your point is well taken. But it was more than just a concern with image. It was also a concern with honor and reputation.
Take us back earlier to it wasn't only posterity he was thinking about. He was thinking all the way through about the role he would play. He wanted it to be a great one. You know, how did he position himself for the highest of positions, commander-in-chief and then president, that he ultimately achieved?
Well, what happens, you know, this is a very interesting story because George Washington, as a young man, he's very ambitious. In certain ways, he's not a particularly attractive character. His original resentments against the British are really self-interested. He's very upset that the British don't give him a royal commission in the British Army.
Mm-hmm.
He's very upset that London merchants are selling him shoddy overpriced goods. He's very upset after the French and Indian War when the British closed settlement west of the Alleghenies. He's in Washington, like a lot of the Virginia planters, is scooping up land there. But then what happens, it's quite miraculous, with the Stamp Act, the Townsend duties, the Intolerable Acts, this man who has been, frankly, pursuing money, status, and power, suddenly begins to see that his personal grievances are part of this much larger, this universal problem, and the particular becomes abstract, and he finds his voice, and it's a militant voice. And at that point, he has the military experience. He has the force of character. And very importantly, Tom, he is somebody who is always respectful of military subordination to civilian power. And this runs throughout his entire career. So here's a war being fought against abuses of executive power. And so the Continental Congress is looking for somebody whom they can trust not to abuse power and also to ultimately subordinate himself to their views. So Washington was ideal in all sorts of ways.
He and Martha have no children, so there wouldn't be an heir if he was tempted. Raymond in Plattsburgh, New York. Raymond, you're on the air with Ron Chernow.
Thank you. I'm going to be talking or commenting on the French and Indian War and his conduct during that war. At the end, he came up against the Marquis de Repentigny, one of my ancestors, and he was literally forced to sign a surrender document. And in that document, because he couldn't read French, he admitted to the killing of a French ambassador, which had later effects when it came to European countries supporting the American cause during the Revolution, if I'm correct.
Let us pick it up right there, Raymond. Ron?
Yeah, no, you point to a very interesting episode. Very early, before the French and Indian War is officially declared, Washington is involved in killing a Frenchman who turns out to have been an emissary carrying an important diplomatic message. Washington felt that the way this Frenchman and the party of soldiers with him, the way that they were acting, Washington thought that they were actually spies who were pursuing him. And so Washington pounces down on their camp and kills them. The French and Indians then retaliate in overwhelming numbers. George Washington finds himself in his first major military conflict presiding over a massacre of his own men and ends up signing these articles of capitulation in which he admits to having assassinated this French diplomat. Washington claims that this was really, it was late at night, it was dark. The problem was that the French translator did not translate it accurately, but actually it turned out to be a moment of global significance because this was the moment when the French and British empires were clashing in the Ohio country, the area that's today southwestern Pennsylvania, Indiana, Ohio, etc. So in many ways, it was the opening shot of the French and Indian War. So good question.
And of course, France would ultimately become absolutely critical in the Revolutionary War. Talk to us about Washington's record in that war. His win-loss record was in the negative side. You say he wasn't a particularly nimble or fine strategist, and nevertheless, you give him top credits as a commander-in-chief. Why?
No, Washington actually probably loses more battles than he wins during the war. He bungles a number of major battles, either through faulty intelligence or poor strategy. But what I argue is that you can't judge him by the usual scorecard of battles lost and won, because Washington is trying to hold together this army for 8.5 years, Tom. On a daily basis, he's experiencing shortages of money, manpower, clothing, blankets, shoes. Gunpowder. He's dealing with 14 different masters, not only 13 state governments, but this constantly squabbling and bickering Continental Congress. He's dealing with short enlistments where the army dissolves, you know, every December and then has to be reconstituted every January. So Washington shows a political genius that really turns out to more than make up for his military failings, but purely as a general, I would only give him middling grades. But there was no other general who could have stepped into his shoes and had the same outcome in the war, because here are all of these other generals. They're jockeying for power and position. The great thing about George Washington is he keeps his eye on the goal.
The only commander-in-chief in American history, you remind us, to actually take to the field. And that wasn't just a turn of phrase here. I mean, I forget which battle it was, but he's on his horse out front right in the teeth of British fire.
Well, you know, actually what happens later on when he's president, you know, we say president is commander-in-chief, but we think of him, you know, sitting in the White House ordering his generals overseas, whereas during the Whiskey Rebellion in 1794, when there was a massive rebellion in western Pennsylvania against the excise tax on distilled spirits, the so-called whiskey tax, George Washington rides out from Philadelphia in a carriage and takes charge of an army of 12 or 13,000 militiamen.
Think of that, Barack Obama, going to war on your own people to impose a tax.
So it shows you that when we say the president is commander-in-chief, you know, there's more than the theoretical possibility of his actually leading it. Of course, that hasn't happened since Washington put down the Whiskey Rebellion.
Probably a good thing. Augusta, Georgia. Carrie, you're on the air with Ron Chernow.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a political science major at Augusta State University, and you know, when we talk about Washington, a lot of times he's portrayed as, you know, he reluctantly took the White House, the presidency. He didn't really have the ambition to be president. He just did it out of a sense of duty, and I'm just wondering if that is how true that is. If maybe he did have some part of him that perhaps did want to be the leader of the country, the first leader of this country, or if he really was that selfless and had that strong of a sense of duty.
Thanks, Carrie. That gets right to it. Ron?
Excellent question. Well, I guess, you know, the cynical interpretation is that Washington learned starting in 1775 that the more he refused power, the more he rebuffed power, the more eager people were to give it to him. But, you know, I think that what happened was this. George Washington is commander-in-chief of the Continental Army for 8.5 years. During that 8.5-year period, he only returns home to Mount Vernon once for 3 days. So that when he goes back to Mount Vernon at the end of the war, this is a man who is just, you know, craving a little piece of privacy. Yeah. He's then pulled out of retirement for the Constitutional Convention, of which he was the president. And then he's pulled out of retirement again as president. I think he was genuinely reluctant, and I say that because we know from going through his personal papers that he intended to only serve as the first president for a year or two and then step down, having established the legitimacy of the government. Of course, what then happened, every time he was about to resign, there would be another crisis, and his colleagues would say to him, you can't step down in the middle of this crisis. And so he ended up serving for two full terms for 8 years. But I think that he really felt that during the last quarter century of his life, he had really been
denied the pleasures of a private life.
Let's go to Utah, Grantsville, Utah, and Merrill. Merrill, you're on with Ron Chernow.
Oh, thank you very much. I admire your scholarship on George Washington. One of things I wondered about his life is that there is a famous painting of George Washington praying at Valley Forge. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you had been able to verify in your study that he was a praying man, did have a spiritual component in his leadership, and whether there actually was a prayer at Valley Forge in which maybe he saw some kind of a vision of the future of America and his role that he would play in establishing freedom here.
Merrill, I'm very glad for your call. And Ron, I hope you get very specific, not just in Valley Forge, but about Washington's view of religion, because, of course, this is something that's, you know, that's fought over a lot, even now.
This is complicated and it's controversial. Let me see how I can simplify this. Washington, I think, was a very, very religious man. In fact, every battle during his life that he won, he credited Providence. He thought that Providence was responsible for the success of the Constitutional Convention, you know, for the founding of the country. So this is a man who's constantly making reference to a higher power. There were only two or three times in his life that he actually spoke of Jesus Christ. He tended, as did a lot of figures in the 18th century, to speak of Providence or the supreme author of our being.
So was he Christian or a deist?
Well, some people say that he was an atypical Christian for the following reason. His church attendance was somewhat irregular. He did not kneel when he prayed. He did not take communion. I should say before the Revolutionary War, he was an Anglican, which meant mm-hmm. that after the Revolutionary War, he was an Episcopalian. He did not call for a minister on his deathbed. So there are these various, you know, indications that he doesn't seem to have been an evangelical Christian as we know it. I'm a bit dubious about the image of Washington praying at Valley Forge. And I say that to Merrill not because I think that he wasn't religious. I suspect that he was doing a lot of praying at Valley Forge given the situation. I say that because that would have been for Washington to be praying, you know, in a clearing where people could see him. Washington would have thought that that was kind of ostentatiously exhibiting his religion. I think that both he and Martha were very, very private in their devotions. That image has been, you know, repainted many, many different times, so it's become part of our consciousness. But there's no authenticated proof that it actually happened, I'm skeptical.
In the current kind of debate, then, when people say this was founded as a Christian nation, what did you learn in the history of George Washington to speak
well,
to that?
Well, I think George Washington was our foremost apostle of religious tolerance and freedom. And people often ask me, what would he think about the mosque at Ground Zero? I don't know. It's always a dangerous exercise to try to, you know, resurrect founding fathers to comment.
He did write to the synagogue, famously, in Newport, Rhode Island.
Yes. In fact, I would love to quote from that.
Because, we've just got half a minute before the break. Is it short, Ron? I don't know what you've got.
Yeah, he said he wrote to this man who was concerned about whether Jews would have religious freedom. He said, "The government of the United States gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance. It requires only that those who live under its protection should demean themselves, that is, behave themselves as good citizens."
Period.
Period.
That could be a letter written, I suppose, to the Islamic Center in Lower Manhattan.
Yes, and you know, in fact, there's a wonderful letter where Washington was hiring a carpenter and bricklayer at Mount Vernon, and he wrote to his state manager. He said, and he writes this: "I don't care if he's Jewish, Christian, Muslim, or even an atheist, as long as he's competent.
Just bring me a good carpenter." Here's "Follow Washington," sung by the Oscar Brand, song in honor of the George Washington, dating back to the Revolutionary War era. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
With heart in hand and God our trust, we'll freely fight. Our cause is just. March on, my lads. Lads, march on and follow Washington. The day is broke, my lads. March on and follow, follow Washington. 'Tis he that leads the way, my lads. 'Tis he that leads the way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real George Washington, the passionate man behind the wooden mythology. With biographer Ron Chernow, his big new book is Washington, A Life. Ron, some quick points on detail here. You say he was a master showman, a brilliant sense of political stagecraft. He would exercise that when he came into town.
Yes. In fact, you know, it was by design that the publisher put on the cover a picture of George Washington on a white horse. He knew he looked magnificent on horseback. Jefferson said he was the greatest horseman of the age. What Washington would do if he traveled between towns by coach when he was outside of town, he would dismount from the coach. He always brought along one or two white parade horses, and then he would ride into town on the white horse because he knew that that's how people wanted to see him. So this was a man who certainly had a sense of political theater.
Obsessed with his personal appearance, you write, and that extended even to his personal guard. They had to be of a particular size.
Yes, this is an amazing story. During the Revolutionary War, he decides that he wants to create a personal guard to protect him, to protect his papers. And at first, he tells his officers that no member of his guard can be shorter than 5'8" or taller than 5'10". he's then not satisfied with that. The following year, he narrows the specifications to no shorter than 5'9" and no taller than 5'10".
But still 2 inches shorter than him, tall for that time, but not as tall as he.
You know, Washington really, I think, thought that personal appearance was kind of a mark of inner order. He was always very, very meticulous about his own appearance, and he wanted to be surrounded by people who looked good.
Land rich and cash poor, had to borrow money to attend his own inauguration in New York City in 1789.
This is amazing because it's often said, you know, Washington was the richest man of the time, one of the richest men of the time. And yet I found him to be someone who was constantly preoccupied with the straitened conditions of his finances. He has to borrow money to go to his first inauguration in New York in 1789. And then at the end of his second term, government having moved to Philadelphia, he then has to borrow money to bring himself and Martha and the slaves and the whole retinue back to Virginia. So he, in fact, even as president, Tom, you see him writing letters to people who owe him money or different tenants who are behind on their payments. Yes. There was always a tremendous source of anxiety about financial security.
You mentioned Jefferson. He had a very difficult relationship with Thomas Jefferson. What was that? Their view of the world or of American politics? Why?
Yeah, I think that you know, when he appoints Jefferson as first Secretary of State, he has tremendous admiration for Jefferson's political and literary abilities. You know, mind you, they're both Virginia planters, and Washington himself, kind of like Jefferson, was something of a Renaissance man. What happens is that Jefferson becomes really obsessed with states' rights and limited government and strict construction of the Constitution. Washington is a believer in federal power. Within that federal power, you know, a strong executive, believes in a more liberal interpretation of the Constitution.
And quite expansive power. He wanted to shape this country.
Yes. Washington and Hamilton begin to argue quite vigorously about what we call strict construction of the Constitution. And Jefferson is very alarmed by the growth of federal power. And what happens is that Jefferson was a very courtly man. He did not like open confrontations. But through a series of surrogates, he begins to attack Washington's administration, even though he's the Secretary of State. And then finally, a letter is published that Jefferson had written to a friend in Italy, where he says to the friend, "You would be amazed at the heresies that have crept into our system. You know, those who were Samsons in the field and Solomons in the council have had their heads shorn by the harlot England." Washington was very – yeah, this was very strong
language. What did he mean by that? Washington was close to England?
He felt that Washington had sold out to the British. You know, the other major debate of the 1790s was the Jeffersonian were pro-French and the Hamiltonians were pro-British. But, you know, one extraordinary thing that I discovered during Washington's final years, he was not on speaking terms with Jefferson.
Yeah.
After Washington dies, Jefferson makes a very political trip to Mount Vernon to pay his respects to the widow Washington. Martha Washington says two things afterwards. One, she said that The second worst day of her life was the day that Thomas Jefferson visited Mount Vernon, the worst day having been the day her husband died.
Wow.
The second thing that she says to friends is that she considered Thomas Jefferson the most detestable of mankind. Very strong language from Martha Washington. She usually did not express herself quite that forcefully.
Not at all. There's Martha Washington's passion. Give us a couple of illustrations of, you make much of the passion behind George Washington's calm facade. Where do you point? Where do you see that?
There's a story that Jefferson told, which is quite extraordinary. There was a cabinet meeting where Washington was really being vilified by the opposition press. And one of the cabinet members brought in a satirical cartoon that showed Washington being guillotined the way that Louis XVI was. And Jefferson wrote a memo the next day in which he said that Washington flew into a passion where for several minutes he had difficulty regaining control of his emotions, and Washington said to his cabinet that he had regretted staying on as president every single day that he'd been in the office. He expresses himself, you know, very, very vehemently on this. And the interesting thing, Tom, is, you know, that I'm trying to kind of change somewhat, not entirely, but somewhat the portrait of Washington. But it's the people who knew him best that saw this side of him. Jefferson, for instance, said of Washington that Washington was naturally high-toned, and high-toned in 18th-century lingo meant irritable or high-strung. Again, not the way that we see Washington. So, I mean, so this was not a man of marble, but it was the people who worked with him on a daily basis. You know, no man is a hero to his valet. I mean, it was the people who saw him on a daily basis who realized all of this emotion that was simmering under the surface.
Speaking of valet and much more than valet, take us to the very difficult and complicated, quite fascinating issue of Washington and his slaves. There's a big story there. Take us into it.
There's a big story. You know, I try to give a very cold and searching look into Washington as a slaveholder, because it's always said that Washington was a relatively benign slaveholder, and that kind of trips off the tongue a little too easily.
You know,
he owned 300 human beings.
Most of them came by way of Martha.
Probably almost two-thirds of them by way of Martha. And, you know, on the one hand, he took very good medical care of the slaves. Well, you could say they were his property, so he was protecting his property. Unlike many slaveholders, Washington recognized slave marriages, slave families, tried not to break up marriages and families. So that's all to the good, to the extent that you could say something was good within the context of slavery. But, you know, what I discovered was that Washington felt he was giving them food, he was giving them a board, and he expected them to work very hard in exchange. He didn't really see that it was not rational for any slave to want to, you know, work very hard. And I was very struck. I found a series of entries in his diaries from the mid-1780s after he goes home after the war. And he's recording in his diaries that this is the coldest record.
The weather.
The coldest winter on record in Virginia. So cold that Washington, who was a very rugged character, said that it was even too cold for him to go outside riding. And yet he's checking in with the five overseers of his five farms, making sure that all the slaves are out in the fields, you know, and they're pulling up stumps and they're draining swamps and they're doing really heavy labor. And even in this coldest weather that he's ever experienced, he can't let up. And he himself had a tremendous work ethic and couldn't see why. No slave would have any conceivable reason for exerting himself or herself very hard in this horrible situation.
Did he buy and use the teeth of slaves in his dentures?
Yeah, he did. I know this sounds ghoulish.
It does.
But in the 18th century, the dentists would commonly advertise for teeth, and then the teeth would be, you know, inserted as implants or inserted in dentures.
Wow. Mm.
And so I guess, but I have to tell you, very often those advertisements in the newspapers would say white teeth only. So Washington, in a weird kind of way, was being high-minded that he didn't mind having, you know, teeth from his slaves. The 18th century is a foreign country, lot of very strange things.
It's all relative to some kind of level. But then he was absolutely alone among the founders in death, in calling for in having his slaves freed.
This is amazing. Yeah, of the 300 slaves, there were 124 who were directly under his personal legal control. The others had been brought to the marriage by Martha. They were the so-called dower slaves pledged to her legal heirs. So Washington, in his will, and he wrote this by himself without consulting anyone, said that the day that Martha died, that those 124 slaves were freed. Not only freed, but that those who were too old to work, there would be a fund to take care of them, that those who were too young to work, that funds would be set aside in order to train and educate them. This was extraordinarily farsighted. He hoped that when the will was published, that not only other founders but other American slaveholders would be inspired to free their slaves, but it did not happen.
Fascinatingly, Martha, you grew terrified at the prospect of those 124 slaves coming to know that they would be freed upon her death.
This is extraordinary because George Washington had thought this through in extraordinary detail. There was just one glaring thing that he overlooked,
I guess,
which was the will was published. Of the 300 slaves at Mount Vernon, they all knew whether they were one of Washington's slaves or one of the dower slaves. So those 124 who were going to be free, every time they looked at Martha Washington, said to themselves, you know, every time that lady, the moment that that lady dies, I'm a free person. Martha became so unnerved by the situation, she was so afraid for her personal safety that she consulted with George's nephew, Bushrod Washington, who was a Supreme Court justice, and Bushrod said, go ahead and just free them now, which she did. So actually, a year after George Washington died, those 124 slaves were freed.
Let's get a call from Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill. Bill, you're on the air.
You just touched on something that I was going to bring up, namely Washington and his slaves. There's a book out called An Imperfect God, and I think the subtitle is something along the lines of Washington's relationship with his slaves. I must tell you, I read that book. It was flawless, the scholarship to it. I came away from that book with even more admiration for Washington than I did before. He had a quality to be introspective, like Lincoln and Truman. He went into life with certain prejudices, came out and said, wait a minute, everything that I started out with that I thought I believed, I've come to find out is incorrect. And he believed, he came against the norms of his society, slavery being one of them. It was a very, very complicated situation at that time for anybody freeing their slaves. By the way, I wanted to cover one other point. At Washington's battles, yes, he did lose more than he won. But number one, his whole point was trying to keep his army together to wear the British down.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ron makes that point big time in the book. What about his progress on his thinking about the African-American over the course
well,
of the
Well, you life. Know, I think it's a very, very good comment from the caller in the book Imperfect God by Henry Weinsack. It's a very good book, so I'm glad that you mentioned it. Washington is capable of constant self-criticism. This impressed me in so many respects. He becomes somebody so much better than you would have dreamed possible when he was young. So he's born into a world where slavery is not only completely commonplace, but it's unquestioned. And yet by the end of his life, he's doing this remarkably courageous and farsighted act in terms of freeing his own slaves. And Jefferson didn't do that. Madison didn't do that, you know, and they made kind of, you know, much more of a show in many ways in terms of, you know, their regard for freedom. And so that, as in so many ways, Washington just tremendously transcends his origins.
People still think a lot about George Washington. Here's a Facebook comment from Suzanne. She says, I used to live across the river from the Trenton Barracks, down the hill from the home Washington stayed at when reconnoitering the site in the week before he crossed the Delaware, the famous scene. She says, I would often imagine him spyglass in hand while walking my dogs along the riverfront. For Americans, for President Barack Obama in particular, looking back on this president, what can they learn? What might we think?
I think that there's a lot that Obama could learn. You know, for one thing, Tom, Obama got into office hoping that he would somehow rise above partisanship and that we would have a very reasonable and civilized
discourse.
So did Washington, with unfortunately the same results. And in fact, within a year or two of Washington's first term, not only did we have the rise of the two-party system, but it actually rose out of his own cabinet. His Treasury Secretary Hamilton is heading one party, and his Secretary of State Jefferson is the other. But I think that there are so many different secrets of leadership that President Obama, you know, anyone could learn from Washington. Washington never confused leadership with popularity. He did not think that you stooped or courted. You know, you consulted your own principles and experience. He felt that the important thing was to be respected. I think that what he showed was that if you're respected long enough, you will not only be liked, but you will be loved. But if you seek to be liked or loved, you will not. You know, and I was just rereading the farewell address, and Washington was amazingly prophetic in terms of what he wanted us to remember. And in fact, the farewell address is not only an eloquent plea for national unity, but he talks again and again about the baneful spirit of faction, or what they called how it was the way they called party. Let me just read, if I may, a couple of lines from the farewell address. "The common and continual mischiefs of the spirit of party are sufficient to make it the interest and the duty of a wise people to discourage and restrain it. It serves always to distract the public councils and enfeeble the public administration. It agitates the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms, kindles the animosity of one part against another." I mean, these are still very powerful words.
It could hardly be more relevant. Watch out for that baneful spirit of faction. Ron Chernow, it was a great read. Who knew that there was so much more to learn about this man, and yet you take us through in a very fresh way. Thanks so much for being with us today, and thanks for the book. Just terrific.
This was a pure pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Ron Chernow, great biographer, author of the new book, Washington, A Life. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook.